History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. When a population converts to a new belief system, how long does it take for those beliefs to trickle down through all of society? This is a question that's been asked and answered in many different places throughout history. For example, the conversion of the Roman Empire to Christianity. Some would argue that there was a long-term holdout of pagan beliefs among the population. And long after the elites had been converted to Christianity, there were still locals and peasants and others who were still pagans. And it took a mop-up operation, so to speak, of elites co-opting some of the peasants' beliefs, their pagan beliefs, into Christianity so that they would convert. For example, there's an argument that the Christian celebration is actually a co-opting of Saturnalia, a Roman festival in honor of the god Saturn. In Turkish history, some have argued that the reason modern-day Turkey in its practice of Islam is less dogmatic than in places such as Saudi Arabia is due to its animistic past before they were converted to Islam 1,000 years ago in Central Asia. I don't think this is terribly convincing because I don't think such beliefs would linger very long. But the influence of mystical strands of Islam, such as Alevism, I think has had much more influence on modern day Turkey. Anyway, the reason I'm giving this long preamble is because I have a guest today who's going to talk about how the influence of the Russian Orthodox Church actually extended long into the Soviet Union, and not just as an underground church, but had direct impact on Soviet ideology and even on the leadership methods of Joseph Stalin. Today's guest is Russian scholar Jim Curtis, a professor emeritus, and he's the author of the new book, Stalin's Soviet Monastery. He develops a theory of the Russian Revolution and argues that it had little to do with Marx and everything to do with Russia's century-old history of Orthodox monasticism. He places great emphasis on the experience of Joseph Stalin and his only experience of formal education, which was 3 years and 9 months, that he spent as a teenager in an Orthodox seminary studying to be a priest. When he achieved enormous power as General Secretary of the Communist Party, he acted as the sadistic head of a monastery who twisted Orthodox vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience into such things as forcing slave labor in the gulags to build railroads that went to nowhere, as some sort of distortion of passion suffering. Curtis argues that you see this appear in other places, like Russians perceiving Lenin as a Christ figure with appropriate symbolism. So in this episode, we're talking about the history of the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union, but we're also looking at the long half-lives of old belief systems and how when one regime ends and another regime begins and they bring with them their new religion or their new ideology or whatever, old beliefs die very hard, and sometimes they have to be co-opted in very creative ways, and arguably this is what Joseph Stalin did with Russian Orthodoxy. Very interesting revisionist take of the Soviet Union, and there's a lot to explore here, so I hope you enjoy this discussion with Jim Curtis. Jim, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, Scott.
Well, you present a fascinating thesis on the Russian Revolution and also the ideology of Joseph Stalin, and you as a scholar of these fields, I think, is someone who can speak with authority on this revisionist approach. Before we get into it, for listeners who aren't well aware, what is the traditional narrative that historians offer about the Russian Revolution and the influence that Marxism had on it?
The traditional interpretation is to believe what Lenin and the Bolsheviks said. What Lenin said to anybody who would listen is this: I read Marx. Marx opened my eyes to the way things really are, which is the evil influence of capital and capitalism, and we are reacting against that. I am saying what I am saying, the Bolshevik Party is doing what it's doing because we read Marx. And Lenin told anybody who would listen, as did Stalin, well, yes, we are atheists, and as a result, the Cold War started from there. The Cold War used the idea that all politicians always tell the truth, and that if Lenin and Stalin said they were atheists, well, then the Bolshevik Party must consist of godless communists.
All right. which again, I think it's fair to not take Stalin and Lenin at their word, since they have done things that would not allow us to give them the complete benefit of the doubt. Bringing in your theory on the influence of Orthodox monasticism. Now, this is a vast subject. It has a history in the Russia going arguably back a millennium. But what do we need to know about this as context for how you say it influences the Russian Revolution?
Here's what I would argue. I take very seriously modern theories of linguistics and specifically the way people talk, the way people use language. Lenin used language, Stalin used language. Well, those uses of language are themselves subject to linguistic analysis. And what we know from modern linguistics, especially from the work of most influential linguists, namely Noam Chomsky, is that language has a surface structure and has a deep structure. The deep structure of English, Scott, for example, is not accessible to you and me, although we're native speakers of English. We internalize it. We make it part of ourselves. If you apply that to the way people talk, and specifically the way politicians talk, then what you have is a situation in which the surface structure of what people say is that we believe in Marx, yada, yada, yada. If, however, you go beneath that and you examine the deep structure, what you find is something that looks like this. In the context of 1917, 1918, the revolution and civil war and complete civil chaos, Russians needed to fall back on what they knew. And what they knew was Orthodox monasticism. The Orthodox Church is the least well-known of the three branches of Christianity. The Orthodox Church is specifically and generally a monastic religion. Does not rely on theology, as Protestantism and Catholicism do. Rather, it relies on ritual. And where do those rituals take place? They take place inside the church, which is preferably located inside a monastery. Thus, I arrive at the following conclusion. Well, if it is the case that the deep structure of the Soviet Union was Orthodox monasticism, which everybody had grown up with, then some really important conclusions arrive from that. For example, if what is important is the monastery, then the monastery, by definition, is disconnected from the outside world. Therefore, the Communist Party, indeed, like many Russian rulers in the past, was disconnected from the outside world. The Communist Party was dedicated to bringing about something like a general monastic system in the outside world. It's really, really important to understand that Stalin's only experience of formal education was in an Orthodox monastery. For about the period of 4 years, during his formative teenage years, he studied to be a priest. And when he achieved enormous power as General Secretary of the Communist Party, I argue that he acted as a sadistic elder of a monastery, that he imposed vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience on the Soviet people in general. This is a way of dealing with and understanding Soviet history that doesn't involve contradictions. Another part of the standard line, if I put it like that, about Soviet history is that, well, there are contradictions. Lenin said that he was in favor of humanism and liberty and all that, but on the other hand, he was obviously a sadistic murderer. He was obviously an authoritarian. He approved the assassination of the Tsar and his wife and their children and so forth. These contradictions are thought to be what makes Soviet interesting and important. What I say is there are no contradictions in history. People do what they do for reasons that they cannot ever fully articulate.
I'd love to walk through your linguistic analysis of Stalin and others and the evidence that you see where there's a Orthodox substratum in Soviet ideology. So could you walk me through that from the beginning in statements you see made by Stalin or others that led to you arriving at this conclusion?
Well, let's see. What we begin with is the background of Soviet leaders. As I said, they all grew up in Orthodox monasticism. That's what they knew. That's what they were familiar with. No matter whether they said they rebelled against it, it was part of them. We have a situation in which Stalin attended an Orthodox seminary. Anastas Mikoyan, who was a member of the Central Committee and one of Stalin's closest associates, went to the same monastery. Andrei Zhdanov, who was, shall we say, Stalin's front man, who made the speeches that Stalin did not want to make, was the son of a professor of theology, the environment, the general environment of the Communist Party was one in which Orthodox monasticism was a predominant attitude. I use a word that is, in Russian, it's called tsidakovnost, which is translated as churchiness. A general part of an understanding of religion in the world goes like this, that religion is not and cannot ever be limited to just the specific beliefs and practices of believers. Religion has a more general social meaning. This is the case of the with Protestantism, which took over Western Europe and reformed not just religious practices, but attitudes in general. I say that that is also the case with regard to Lenin. Now then, with regard to the way Lenin operated, when an elder in a monastery, or for that matter, Jesus in the Bible, said things, these were things that people said, and over again, if you read the Bible, as I cite the Bible a number of times in the book, the response to people who deliver what I call the monological word is rejoicing. The leader speaks the truth, and the people rejoice. Since the Communist Party was still, shall we say, in the thrall of monasticism, was not connected to the world, let us talk about the most infamous part of the Soviet system, the Gulag, this vast slavery system that was instituted as the subject of Solzhenitsyn's famous book, The Gulag Archipelago. It's a remarkable thing. There are two things that we really people need to understand about the Gulag. The first is this. From time to time, Stalin would say, let's do thus and such. This is a task. He loved that word. This is a task for the Soviet Union. The most famous of these was the Belomor Canal, canal built in north of Russia. Why did they do it? Because Stalin told them to do it. This canal had very limited economic significance. And to this day, they still exist, but it's very little use. There were no studies of economic feasibility done. There was no heavy moving equipment done. The point of building the Belomor Canal was to make people suffer. That's what it did, and that was its conclusion. Over and over again, Stalin would say, do thus and such, and people go out and do thus and such, and then Stalin would say, okay, I'm tired of that, do something else. So that, for example, to this day, there are miles and miles and miles of railroad track out in the middle of Siberia that go nowhere. Stalin would say, go do thus and such. And people would work hard with immense suffering and loss of life. And all of a sudden, okay, Stalin would say, okay, we're done with that. Do something else. My point is that it is not reasonable to think that Stalin had what you call policy objectives. His purpose was to exercise power for the purpose of exercising power. And since Stalin was the way he was, his purpose was to make people suffer. Let me give you one number. If there's one number that people need to understand about the history of the Soviet Union, here it is. We know from current research that the Gulag Archipelago, this vast system, spread all over the Soviet Union, included gold mines and coal mines and cotton plantations and all kinds of things, was costing the Soviet Union 13% of its gross domestic product. Now think about that. This was in effect a system of slave labor because they never paid. Anybody could be arrested anytime, sent off to do hard labor in horrible conditions. But the result of this system was an enormous loss for the Soviet Union. Why is that? Because nobody cared to make it efficient. The purpose was to impose suffering on the Russian people And that's what it did. It did that very successfully. What it did not do was to create a viable economy. And what it did not do was to contribute to the Soviet economy in general. These are just verifiable facts from archival research.
There's a term that you use in your book, passion suffering. This is an orthodox idea, but then as you were describing it, you noted that Stalin was leading through this way and affected some of his policy decisions. Can you describe passion suffering from an orthodox context? And later Soviet rulers, were they cognizant of the fact that they were using and ruling through this concept?
My tentative guess is yes, but what Soviet rulers were cognizant of is problematic issues. Let me address the issue of passion suffering because it's one of the most important keys to understanding Russia and specifically the Soviet Union. Let's begin with this. Orthodox religious services are some of the most beautiful that I've ever witnessed. The churches are beautiful. The singing is absolutely glorious. But any Westerner who goes into an Orthodox church will immediately be struck by the fact that there are no pews. Everybody stands through 5, 6, 7 hour church services on cold stone floors. This is part of the general sense of imitating Christ. In Orthodoxy, the most important thing that Christ did was not to preach love and compassion, but rather to suffer. And therefore, if one wishes to live in a way that imitates Christ, what one does is to suffer. If you wish to achieve sanctity, then you must seek suffering. There is a long, long tradition before the revolution of people who were passion sufferers, who were appropriately canonized for various reasons within the Orthodox Church. Now, this is a mindset. As I say, religion is not and cannot ever be simply a matter of individual belief and practices. It has larger social implications. So, let us agree that what we had in Russia in 1917 was a very large, mostly illiterate country in which religious attitudes had the quality of superstition, were very strongly held, and an essential part of orthodoxy was the belief that it's good to suffer, as one of the characters in a Dostoevsky novel says. If it's good to suffer, and there's a long-term history of suffering, then it is, as it were, the meeting of the minds. Stalin was a sadist. He lived to make people suffer. And the Russian people were predisposed to accept suffering. If you read Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago, you find over and over again examples of people who embrace suffering. He cites the examples of a couple of people who were glad to be arrested because that would make it possible for them to suffer and thereby achieve sanctity. Now, to be sure, not everybody believed this. A lot of people hated suffering, hated Stalin and all that, but the fact remains is that there's a large-scale attitude that predisposed people to accept who Stalin was and what Stalin did.
Well, you can't argue with Stalin's effectiveness in the sense that he was never assassinated. He held on to his premiership until the end of his life. Was he cognizant that he was using the grammar of Russian society to effectively rule? And yes, there were orthodox elements, but it was so baked into Russian society, you couldn't help but use it. Do you think he was cognizant, or was he just so good at absorbing effective realpolitik that he did so without even being aware of it?
Well, I have a short answer and a longer answer. My short answer is yes. I do believe that he understood what he was doing. However, there's something really, really important about Stalin that people need to understand. Stalin was maybe the greatest actor of the 20th century. To use another term, Stalin was a shapeshifter. Stalin had the extraordinary, really extraordinary ability to change his personality at a moment's notice. Basically, Stalin could be anybody he wanted to be at any moment when it would suit his purposes. For example, when Stalin and Churchill and Harry Truman went to the Potsdam Conference in 1946 after World War II to negotiate the peace and how that would be set up, Stalin was a suave international diplomat. It's just amazing. If you read what Harry Truman said when he went back to Washington, he raved about Stalin. He couldn't get over what a nice guy Stalin was because that was the persona that Stalin knew he needed to adapt to achieve his goals, namely imperialism in Eastern Europe. At any other moment, he could be a simple peasant. One of his favorite roles was a simple peasant. A lot of times, we have records for this, a lot of times, Stalin wouldn't even take the podium or conduct meetings. When important meetings about important topics were held, Stalin would sit at the back of the room. He would come in late. He would just sit there and not say anything because what he wanted to do was observe and let people trap themselves. That was a persona they adopted. And my way of thinking about it is this, that a lot of people, like Truman, took whoever Stalin was at any given moment as the real Stalin. It is essential to understand there was no real Stalin. Stalin was whoever you wanted to be at any given moment. And as a result, lots of people were taken in, and lots of those people died as a result.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. I haven't read any psychological analyses of Stalin, but I wonder, he sounds a lot like a sociopath in that he's aware of the needs and the desires of other people. Sociopaths are usually excellent confidence men. They know how to manipulate others for their own ends. They can be very charming and shift personas for the situation, as you said. They just simply don't care about the suffering they inflict, whereas a psychopath doesn't even understand the suffering, so they're not as effective as con men and whatnot. What would you make of him psychologically, Stalin?
That's, you just put it very well. Yes, clearly he was a psychopath, but he was, so to speak, in control of his pathology, which is that means that he was able to use it for his own purposes. Yeah, I don't think there's any reasonable doubt about the fact that Stalin was a psychopath. He was, however, an exceptionally effective one, because he used his power in a situation in which people were, as I say, receptive to the attitude that the leader knows all, and that if the leader creates suffering, well, that's ultimately a good thing because it makes people holy.
I'm curious about blowback you've received about your theory from other academics. For non-scholars who are listening, as I'm sure you're very well of this, academics can be very petty, especially when their pet theories are being attacked. And ideas in scholarship have an incredibly long half-life.
That's a good way of saying it.
Right. I mean, that for my field of study, the idea from when the Ottoman Empire moved to the Turkish Republic, it was sort of the defeat of religious ideology to secularism. And secularism won, and it created the firm foundations of the Turkish Republic. Now, newer studies have been challenging this for a couple of decades, but there's still strong bastions of support of this cleave from a religious society to a secular society throughout institutions in Turkey and abroad that look at Turkey and the Ottoman Empire. What sort of criticism have you received as you discuss about the ideas of latent orthodoxy that existed in the Soviet Union?
Well, I may have noticed we are in a pandemic, and that's just slowed everything down, getting reviews and getting word about the book out. So I've only gotten one review, but the standard responses, of course, that Curtis does not take into account the views of other scholars and so forth. So I wait that I'm doing podcasts. I also put out the word for a number of reviews. It may take another year or so before there's anything like scholarly consensus that appears.
I'd like to hear about other statements, other actions that jumped out to you. You had mentioned Stalin commissioning railroad lines that essentially went nowhere. Mm-hmm. He was taking on the persona of an abbot,
yep,
or a bishop in a monastery, directing the spiritual formation, mm-hmm, of his congregants, or in this case, not the spiritual formation, but the Sovietization of his subjects. Are there other things that he and others did that stuck out to you as essentially orthodox actions?
Yes. It begins with, let me address that indirectly by talking about Lenin as Christ. As I say, I think it's essential to understand that Russia was in a state of chaos, never mind what Lenin said, in the years from roughly the revolution, the 7 years from roughly the revolution until Lenin's death in 1924. When Lenin died in 1924, he was treated the only way Russians knew how to treat a leader. They treated him as a Christ figure. so that there was a there were long lines that were people in which people waited to pay their last respect to Lenin. They put palm trees, as you would expect people to do on Palm Sunday, in the building where his body lay in state. And of course, ultimately, he was put in a sacred space and his body was placed on display. It's very, very striking that there's a very close analogy between the treatment of Lenin's body and the treatment of saints in Italy. There is a Saint Santa Chita Chiara in Italian, who was the friend of Saint Francis of Assisi, whose body is displayed exactly the way Lenin's body. Her literal desiccated body is on display in a crypt in a church devoted to her, and people, the faithful, go there to worship and pay their respects, just as Lenin did. Now, I'm coming to Stalin. The key, I think one key to Stalin's, shall we say, successful sadism is this. On one hand, he was so narcissistic that he, of course, was jealous of Lenin. Because after all, there's one of the unanswerable questions in Stalinism was sort of like this. What is the relation between Lenin and Stalin? If Lenin knew all, and that was the mythology, Lenin understood everything, Lenin showed us the way to do everything, Lenin has solved all problems. If that's the case, what's left for Stalin to do? And the obvious answer to that is nothing, but you couldn't say that because if you did, you would be shot by Stalin's secret police. So I believe that one reason for the aggressive sadism of Stalin is that he couldn't deal with Lenin. He couldn't question Lenin. He couldn't do anything except say, yes, Lenin was really, really wonderful. We have another issue related to this, indicating not that Stalin had policy objectives, but rather that he sort of had this belief in his omniscience, which he couldn't state because of Lenin. And it has to do with this. You would think in the late 30s, everybody knew that war was coming. Everybody knew that Hitler and the Nazis were rearming. You would think that a prudent leader who wanted to build up his country would create a strong army, because after all, that's what would going to be needed in the coming war. Everybody knew it was coming. But what did Stalin do? And this is one of the best known things that Stalin did. He decimated the officer corps. He had the higher level officers of the Soviet Union imprisoned or shot. Why did he do that? Because he could. Because he knew how to do it. Because anybody's power was a threat to his narcissistic belief. Not because they'd done anything wrong. In and of themselves, they were threats to him and had them shot. As a result, when the Nazis invaded in June 22nd, 1941, they met no resistance. They invaded and went across Ukraine as fast as their tanks could go, because basically there was no army, and what the army lost had no bullets.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. I'd like to explore a different topic, because what you're discussing here is a somewhat universal issue of how quickly ideologies can change in a population. Now, as you've described here, even though the Russian Revolution happened swiftly and Russia adopted a discourse of secularism, atheism, you can't simply take an entire population of Russian Orthodox and then also significant Muslim populations and Jewish populations throughout the empire and expect the rest of the population to adopt. That's just simply not tenable. And I always use the Ottoman Empire in Turkey as an analogy. The Turkish Republic was secular, and Turkey was ruled by essentially a secular oligarchy for decades that would dress in Western fashion, drink wine, be essentially nominal Muslims. But the deeply religious Muslim class in Turkey never disappeared. One could argue that in modern day Turkey, Turkey isn't necessarily more religious, but perhaps the religious population have been able to participate more in civic life. And we see this with Russia as well. After the fall of the Soviet Union, different Russian Orthodox and also Muslim and Protestant groups were able to reemerge from the underground. So on the one hand, you can't simply expect a society to turn on a dime. On the other hand, these some people will go the opposite direction and think that these latent ancient beliefs are embedded in amber in a national psyche. So Protestants would say of Catholics that, oh, when the Roman Empire turned to Catholicism, it adopted all these Roman beliefs. So their pantheon of gods just became the Roman Catholic Church's idols. And it stayed that way for 1500 years.
And saints.
Right, exactly. The saints. And it was frozen in amber for 1500 years until Protestantism came along and, you know, freed them of their saints that were actually crypto-Roman gods. So I suppose, what do you see? What does your research say about the transition ideologically? How long do these sort of deeply held beliefs stay on from what you've seen?
Well, you raise things that have numerous implications. One of them I realized in doing the research for the Stalin book is this, which is that basically the Communist Party wanted to take on and defeat the Orthodox Church as the blatant symbol of the oppression of the poor and so forth. And in the battle between the Communist Party and the Orthodox Church, guess who won? The Orthodox Church won. The Orthodox Church won primarily because of the vast stretches of the Russian countryside where nobody could rule effectively and consistently, and specifically because of the beliefs bordering on fanaticism on the part of Russian peasant women. Basically, I think it was Russian peasant women who preserved the church. There are churches way out in the middle of nowhere in places you and I have never heard of and probably wouldn't want to go to in the remote reaches of Russia where the Communist Party couldn't reach or couldn't reach it effectively. However, since you raised this question, let me answer it by addressing this. What has happened in Russia after 1991, after the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991? My answer is, aside from Putin and his enormous wealth, what's been called cryptocracy, what has happened to Russian society? And my answer is, it is renounced monasticism. Ultimately, I believe, and this is something I'm still working through in my own mind, I believe that Stalin and the Communist Party were a massive, horrible, terribly destructive purgative that created a situation in which Russian peasants, Russian people in general, no longer believed as they did in passion suffering. Although there are churches built to the passion sufferers killed. Do you know that, by the way, that Nicholas and Alexander and the imperial family are now officially canonized by the Russian church? They are passion sufferers. There are several churches that have been built in their honor. There's a church built over the house where they were actually murdered in 1918. But more generally, if you examine Russian society today, what do you find? You find coffee shops. You find designers. You find people who are fascinated with popular culture. You find people who are, in general, doing things very much like their counterparts in Eastern Europe and especially in the United States. I think that although there's been these two movements, and it will take a brilliant sociologist to figure out the relationship between them. On one hand, it is very clear that there's been a tremendous resurgence of the Orthodox Church simply because it's now safe to go to church. And people do, in very large numbers. People go to church. Monasteries and convents have been reopened. People are entering them, which is a tremendous story in itself. But also, you have the renunciation of the monasticism that historically the Orthodox Church stood for. So I think what we have in Russia today as a result, as a direct result of Soviet rule, is people who believe in orthodoxy without monasticism. And that is a huge, huge change.
It's a grand irony that Stalin and the Soviet leadership wanted to destroy the Orthodox Church, so they co-opted monasticism. The Orthodox Church won, but it was monasticism itself that died, as you explain. What implications do you think this has for our understanding of the history of Russia and also implications for the future of Russia?
One of the crucial issues in Russia that's very difficult for Westerners to understand is the role of the monastery. I argue that the monastery, the Orthodox monastery, was the crucial institution in Russian life. in part because it created a separation between the people inside the monastery and people outside the monastery. If you examine Russian history for, let us say, the last 400 years, one of the remarkable features of it is the isolation of the rulers. Rulers are separate from the people whom they rule, and this is a carryover of the situation created by monasteries. Moreover, we can then say, is it possible for the Russian people to use monastic life as a guide for life in the outside world? This is one of the crucial questions of Russian life. It's one that greatly agitated Fyodor Dostoevsky, the novelist, and among others. How is it possible for us to take our religious principles that are bounded on monastic life and bring them out into the world? This is, I would say, if Russian history is a tragedy, then this is the root of the tragedy of Russian history, which is that monastic life has not been able to create a viable guide for life in the world for married couples who want to, people who want to get married and raise kids and need normal lives. The religion has not provided an adequate guide for such people, and people have cast about for various kinds of solutions to this dilemma.
Well, this is a fascinating exploration of how ideologies, even when they're attempted to be quashed by rulers, can survive in interesting ways, but then also mutate in ways that no one would really expect.
Mm-hmm. That's a good way to say it, yeah.
Right. So for listeners who want to explore this much more, the name of your book is Stalin's Soviet Monastery, A New Interpretation of Russian Politics. Jim, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's all for today's episode. If you'd like to see show notes with sources, maps, links, anything else related to this episode, and all my other ones as well, go to parthenonpodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network this show is a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support the show, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to it on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the membership program for History Unplugged. If you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes for the entire back catalog, which is about 600 episodes and growing. And all you have to do is go to patreon.com/unplug. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.